Okay, good morning, everybody. I don't have a microphone today, so you'll have to be extra quiet today because I don't have a microphone. All right, but I am recording, so I should be able to get this on the internet. So let's just take a quick look at the schedule right away because, yeah, we should start 10:50. So today is the 16th? No, the 21st, right here. Oh, you had an exam last time. Right, I wasn't here. And I did see the dean on Saturday night. He didn't have a black eye or bloody nose or anything, so that was nice. You guys treated him pretty well. Did he treat you okay? All right, and with regard to those tests, they're run through the Scantron. It took me a little while because we didn't tell everybody to put what version of the test they had, whether it was A or B, so I had to go back and try to figure out what A and B was on some exams. And then on the B version, there was no 73, and a couple of them had two C's for an answer. So I have to go back and manually grade all of those things so you don't get gypped out of points. So tonight I'll have it on Blackboard for you to see. Okay. And if not, you can come and, it will be online for you to see tonight. And if you want to see your exam, then see me during office hours tomorrow. I don't think there's time in lab this week to look over your exams, but I definitely want you to look them over sometime, so next week, unless you see me during office hours. All right. So does anybody have a question regarding the test? No? Okay. Well, give me some feedback. Hopefully the study guides helped you. Let me know if you agreed. Did the study guides help you?
Yeah.
They're kind of like right on what you should know? That was the plan. Okay. So for next time. All right. And then today is the 21st, and we're going to talk about axial skeleton today. And today and Wednesday is your first lab practicum as well, right? And that goes through the skull in your lab book. So remember, your lab book is the answer key to the practical exam. All right. Anybody have a question regarding the exam or the schedule? Exam and schedule, we're both good with that. Okay. Those of you that came in late, didn't hear that you have to be extra quiet today because I don't have my microphone working. All right, so if you want to catch up with somebody, got to step outside because I'll lose my voice. That would be terrible. All right, so axial skeleton. I think you all have a pretty good idea of what the axial skeleton is. All right, so I'll just describe it to you really quick. Axial skeleton, the bones that are included, all the bones of the skull, including the hyoid bone, then the vertebral column, and we're going to see that there's a number of divisions of the vertebral column, like cervical, thoracic, lumbar, sacral, all right, so that's the vertebral column, including the sacrum as part of axial skeleton, then all of the ribs and the sternum, the breastbone, that's axial skeleton. Things that are attached to the axial skeleton are called the appendicular skeleton. So bones of the upper appendage and lower appendages, and then some bones that help attach those appendages to the axial skeleton, like an ascoxae here, or a hip bone, and a clavicle and scapula. All right, but right now we want to focus our attention on the axial skeleton. But since this is more or less the first lecture that you've had on bones, you have to know something about landmarks. And that's what I have on the sheet over here for you, some important landmarks. So a rough area on a bone and a raised area on a bone, if it is rough, right, we would like to call that a process. And the function of a process is that something is going to attach to the bone there. In most cases, a muscle is going to attach to the bone in that location, and a muscle is going to pull on a bone. And guess what happens to a bone when it gets stressed, when something pulls on it? Same thing for a muscle. Bone is living tissue. It gets bigger and stronger there as well. So when you have something attached to a bone, like a muscle, and it's pulling on that location, it just gets bigger and stronger. And that connection between a muscle and a bone is called a tendon. There are other connections. There can be a bone-to-bone connection, and that's called a ligament. All right, so what are some names of processes? Well, process, you just have to know, right? There are a number of processes in the body, and what's the function of a process most of the time? is just going to be two words, muscle attachment, right? You might find some ligaments between places, but just say muscle attachment. A tubercle is a process. A tuberosity is a process. We'll learn where all these are. Trochanter is a process. Tuberosity we find on the humerus up over here, right? A trochanter is going to be on the femur. Malleolus, those are your ankle bones that are sticking out. A crest is a process, but it is long. It's elongated, so it's a long raised area on a bone. For instance, if we look at an ascoxae, this is a crest. Muscles attach right here along the whole length of the tip of that ascoxae. And a spine is a process, but it's long and narrow, right? It's not, it sticks out far, is a spine. And then a line is sort of like a crest, but it's not as tall. It just sticks out a little bit, right? But there's a muscle attaching there, and it's easy to observe. All right, so what's the function of a spine? What's the function of a spine? Same thing as for a process. It is muscle attachment. Yeah, just say muscle attachment. You're going to be right most of the time. What's the function of a trochanter? Muscle attachment, because it is a process. All right, so a process is just a raised area on a bone, but you should palpate it with your fingertip to make sure that it's rough. If it's smooth, that means that it's something else. All right, the second thing, a depression. A depression has a couple different names. The most common thing is fossa. A fossa is a depression, and what's the function of a depression or a fossa in your body? It holds something. It's a bowl, right? A fossa is just a bowl, so it's holding something. And a sulcus is a fossa, but it is elongated, right? So it's not just a circle, it's elongated. And a sulcus and a groove are the same thing. You'd be able to use those interchangeably, but on some bones, sulcus is preferred. On other bones, groove is preferred, but it really doesn't matter. Both the same word. And an alveolus is a fossa or a depression. Maybe a better way to think of an alveolus is that it's a pocket. We have alveoli in a mandible and in our maxillae because that pocket is where a root of a tooth fits into the mandible or maxilla, and so there has to be a pocket to hold that tooth in position, right? That's an alveolus. And the edge of that pocket is called a margin, like the alveolar margin or all the edges of those alveoli that line up on our mandible and maxillae. Okay, a hole. You all know common name for a hole, which is a foramen. And what's the function of a foramen? Passageway. In one word, passageway. That's really nice. Right? So it's a hole in a bone. It's a passageway for an artery or a vein or both. And it could even have a nerve. And it can have all three. It could have nerves, arteries, and veins going through it from one side of a bone to the other. A meatus is a depression, and there's a couple. There's external acoustic and internal acoustic meatus. That's a depression in the temporal bone, right, that allows communication with the petrous region of the temporal bone. And you have some important sense organs in that petrous region, like for hearing and for balance. A canal is a foramen. So what's the function of a canal? Passageway. It's a passageway. But a canal, right, is long. So it's like a tunnel. Probably that's the best way to think of it. A canal is a tunnel. So it doesn't go through a thin part of a bone. It goes through a thick part of the bone, or actually enters the bone and meanders around a little bit before it exits. Right? So that's what we call a canal. A fissure is a foramen. But it's not circular, it's not oval, it's very long. And so, for instance, like the superior orbital fissure, inferior orbital fissure are like lines, right? That's a hole through the sphenoid bone. A sinus. I have it here, but that's actually a cavity. And so it's sort of like a fossa, sort of like a foramen, but it's not open to the outside of the bone. It's just a cavity on the inside of the bone. And I think you had to know some sinuses for the first practicum. How many sinuses did you have to know for first practicum? Okay, two. I hear two. But what really is the number? You know what? It's actually four. What are the four nasal sinuses? You got maxillary, okay, frontal, sphenoid, and ethmoid, right? The four, and oh, you know what? We're going to see, I didn't talk about those. Maybe in lecture I did. I'll show you where those are today. Okay, so if you have a raised area on a bone, but if it's smooth instead of rough, then it's for articulation. It's going to form a joint. Muscle isn't going to attach there. It's going to be a smooth surface so that bones can glide against each other without wearing each other out. And the common name for a smooth articulating surface is a condyle. And a condyle has hyaline cartilage over it, and that helps protect the ends of the bones. A head is usually the proximal epiphysis, but not always. And it's going to be smooth, and that's going to articulate with the bone that's proximal to it. A facet is almost like a fossa. It's a depression. But in this particular case, this depression is going to act as a joint. So another bone is going to associate with a facet, and it's going to have a nice hyaline cartilage lining as well. And what about the surface of a facet? Should it be smooth or rough? It's got to be smooth, right? Joints, if they're healthy, they should be smooth. If they're not smooth, right, then that's a diseased joint. Here are a couple others that are really special. In the next chapter, we'll talk about these. The trochlea and capitulum. These are smooth surfaces. They form a joint, and in particular, a joint in your elbow. So we'll get to that next time. And you know, also a ramus, right? And it's an extension from a major part of the bone. Sometimes we call that the body, and that extension is going to make a bend really close to a 90 degree angle. That's a ramus. Do you know any bones that have a ramus to them?
Mandible.
A mandible, that's exactly right, because that was a quiz probably even a couple of weeks ago. All right, so here's the skeleton. We can break the skeleton into two parts, right? Just like what I see here, the axial skeleton and appendicular. We're not going to talk about appendicular skeleton today, but we're going to focus our attention on axial skeleton. The skull, the hyoid bone. And what should you do with that hyoid bone? What did I tell you in lab? Yeah, don't palpate it. Don't press to find it. Just leave it alone in there because we don't want to fracture that. Right? Vertebral column and then thoracic cage. You don't have to know these numbers, but I just put them there so that you would have an idea of how many bones there are. A lot of bones in your body. Okay, the skull. Let's take a look at the skull. I see it on this illustration pretty nice, but we have much better illustrations. Here are bones of the skull, and I remember talking about this in lab. And for instance, all the bones of the skeleton we can break down into two main groups. The bones of the skull we can break down into two main groups as well. The bones that form the armor plating that protect your brain, we call that cranial, the cranium. And these are cranial bones. And you probably know all these already, like the frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal, okay, sphenoid, and there are others that we can't see, but all of these bones help form the cranial vault, which is where your brain is sitting. The second group of bones are what we call facial bones. These are not associated with the brain, but they're important for articulation, they're important for eating and for breathing, and communication is very important as well. All right, so these are facial bones. So you should be able to break all those skull bones down by how they participate in forming the cranium or not the cranium. If we take the top of the skull off and look inside the cranial vault, did I ever tell anybody what that part of the skull is? If we were to make a nice transverse cut and remove the top part of the cranium? I think I told one lab. I'm not sure if I told everybody, every lab. All right, it's going to be part of the occipital bone, part of temporal, part of parietal, part of the frontal bone. So it's not a particular bone, it's just kind of a contrived bone. If you take a saw and saw off the top of a skull, that's called the calvarium. Calvarium is that part of the skull that looks like a skull cap, right? If you remove that and look a nice superior view into the cranium, we see that there are three major fossas or three depressions, and they move laterally. There's one anterior, one in the middle and one posterior, and hence that's how they got their name. Anterior cranial fossa, the middle cranial fossa, and the posterior cranial fossa. We're going to see certain parts of the brain will be held in these locations. Like the frontal lobe is going to be in the anterior cranial fossa. Temporal lobes, right? Here's a nice temporal bone. The temporal lobes are going to be in the middle cranial fossa, and then this posterior one are going to hold things like the cerebellum and the occipital lobe of the brain. And we'll learn about those. So there are three main fossa. Okay, we can see that. All right, here is that nice quiz figure that you had to know. Does anybody have a question about this thing? I don't think I want to describe this one anymore. You could probably draw this one out. All right, the only thing that I don't have on this list, this list over here, all these important landmarks, is this particular joint. What do we call this, the general name of an immovable joint? These are sutures, right? So these are sutures. You could probably add that to the list over here. And that's a fibrous joint. That's not a smooth joint because, for instance, the parietal bone and temporal bone don't move up against each other. They're locked into position, right? So this joint right here does not have to be smooth. However, the joint between the mandible and the temporal bone, right? Do you see where that is? What is that called? The joint between the mandible and temporal bone. We just want to call that the TMJ. TMJ stands for temporomandibular joint, TMJ, right? We don't have time to say temporomandibular joint all the time. This is the only movable joint in the skull. And since it's a movable joint, this condyle is going to have what kind of surface? A rough surface or a smooth surface? Nice smooth surface, right? Covered with hyaline cartilage. And the mandibular fossa of the temporal bone also is going to have some hyaline cartilage lining it as well. All right, so that's something I didn't mention in lab necessarily. All right, what other nice pictures do we have right here? Kind of a minor point, but here I see a sagittal suture. I see a lambdoid suture, and every once in a while we're going to find a bone that's neither part of the parietal bone or the occipital bone residing in the lambdoid suture and maybe even some other sutures. And I see one here, and I see one here. Sometimes they're called wormian bones because these sutures kind of reminded somebody of a worm, or they could be called sutural bones. And other than that, they really don't have a name to them. Okay? Sutural bones. Let's go back over here. All right. So, here's a nice frontal view. This was not a quiz in lab, but I see a number of nice bones on this illustration of a skull. So, let's go over it. What do we call this depression that holds an eyeball? This is an orbit. All right. So, here's an orbit, and you can see a number of bones make up an orbit. Right, the bones that help make up an orbit would be the frontal bone, right, the zygomatic, the maxilla, the sphenoid, which is posterior, and then the ethmoid bone, which is over here, which maybe you can't see. Oh yeah, I can see it over here, ethmoid bone. Right, so those are bones that make up the orbit, and I can see some fissures. Right, so here, remember, a fissure is a foramen, but it's really long and narrow. So here's the superior orbital fissure. Here's the inferior orbital fissure. And then, who can tell me what this foramen is right here? Optic canal. It's not just a foramen because it's kind of more like a tunnel, right? It's long once you get into the bone. All right, I see a couple other foramina, which we'll use just for nomenclature purposes. I see a foramen below an orbit, so that's going to be the infraorbital foramen. And in some people, there is another foramen that's above the orbit, so we're going to call that the supraorbital foramen. And in a lot of us, it's no longer really a foramen, but a notch. Right? There's just a notch, and that's a passageway for something as well. All right, so the bones that make up the cranium, frontal, parietal, can't see occipital. I see temporal, and then here's the sphenoid bone that goes all the way across. The sphenoid bone over here. Okay, the bones that make up the nose of the bridge, these are nasal bones. And behind the nasal bone is the ethmoid. And the ethmoid has a perpendicular plate to it that helps make this wall or separation between the right and left nasal cavities. This thing is called a septum. And since it's in the nasal cavity, we call this the nasal septum. So the superior part is made out of part of the ethmoid bone. The inferior part right here is a bone all by itself that's called the vomer. I'm not sure I showed the vomer to anybody in lab. That's in your lab manual. But what you should know is that the ethmoid bone and the vomer join together to make the nasal septum. There are some other, I see some wings inside the nasal cavity. These are called conchae. And these are important for humidifying air if it's really dry, or warming air up if air is really cold, or cooling air down if it's really hot so that it doesn't hurt our lungs. It's covered with a mucous membrane, so when we breathe in dust particles, a lot of the dust particles get trapped in that mucus and don't end up in our lungs, which is really nice. Okay, and there are three, and I only see two. I see the inferior, and I see the middle. Right? The inferior is a bone all by itself. I could show you that one in lab, but remember, it's just a wing inside the nasal cavity. Here's the middle one, and the middle one and the superior, which we can't see, is part of the ethmoid bone. It's a pretty small one. All right, so this is a nice frontal view of the skull. Inferior view. So I don't test you on this view, but it's good to put some of these bones together. All right, so here's foramen magnum. What bone is the foramen magnum in? The occipital bone, right? And then here are a couple smooth surfaces. And they're raised, right? But they also have a little depression in them, but they're a raised smooth area. What do we call a raised smooth area on a bone? A condyle. And what's the function of a condyle? It forms an articulation, forms a joint. Okay, so here's the occipital bone. It forms a joint. Could you take a guess at what bone articulates right here? Okay, it's going to be part of the vertebral column, and it's going to be the very first bone in the vertebral column, which is what we call C1, cervical number 1, or the atlas. All right, so when you see these in lab, you can palpate them. Okay, here is that posterior part of the vomer. And what do you know about the vomer? What does it help make up? Part of the nasal septum, right? Because it's right smack on midline. All right, here are some bones that make the hard palate. Hard palate are bones that on the roof of the mouth. Here I can see maxilla. And these are what we call the palatine processes of the maxilla because they articulate with the palatine bone. All right, so here's the maxilla, and it articulates. I see a nice suture here and here. Here is the palatine bone, and that helps make up that posterior part of the hard palate of the mouth. And in lab, you took a look at a palatine bone, and it resembles a letter of the alphabet. Does anybody remember what letter of the alphabet? A palatine bones. It looks like a, looks like an L coming together. So my thumbs would be the roof of the mouth, and then my index fingers would be the wall of a nasal cavity. So I see two palatine bones here. Okay. That's pretty good for skull. Individual bones, you know these really well. Ah, but here is a really good, this probably is an exam figure. All right, so you're familiar with all of these foramina, starting anterior, right, with your nose. You got the olfactory foramina in the ethmoid bone, then optic canal in the sphenoid, and then this series of three, right? The rotundum, ovale, and spinosum there in the sphenoid bone, and then down over here is lacerum. And here, or here exteriorly, would be where your ear is. So there is a meatus, the external acoustic meatus, going indenting into the petrous region of the temporal bone. And then here is the internal acoustic meatus. They would line up really perfectly. Then posterior to that, what do you got? Jugular, foramen magnum, and hypoglossal canal. So those are pretty easy. You should be able to draw that out. That will help you on the practicum quite a bit. All right, so we are able to look into the cranial vault because we've sawed off the top of this skull to look on the inside. And I see it right here. What is this top part of the skull called? That is the calvarium. Yeah, that's the calvarium. Okay. So here is ethmoid bone. And the ethmoid bone has all of these olfactory foramina because there are olfactory nerves that go into your nasal cavity that gives you this sense of smell. So ethmoid bone is pretty important that way. And all those olfactory foramina are in a plate that we call the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. In between the cribriform plates, there's a long spine that sticks up into the brain. That's called the crista galli. Kind of looks like a shark's fin. And that's important because some really tough membranes that surround the brain attach to the crista galli. So the ethmoid bone is pretty interesting because it allows you to smell. It holds your brain in place, so when you turn your head, your brain doesn't slosh around inside your cranium. That's really good. And the ethmoid bone also has sinuses. And the important thing about those sinuses is that it's filled with lymphatic tissue that fights infection. So the ethmoid bone also fights infection for you. And it has those nasal conchae, which help humidify air. It also acts like an air conditioner. So this ethmoid bone probably is my favorite bone of the skull because it's doing so many things, right? It's holding the brain and it gives you the sense of smell, helps fight infection, all of that kind of stuff. So that's good for the skull. This area right here in the sphenoid bone, right below this depression, is the body of the sphenoid bone. And if we were to break the sphenoid bone open, we would see that there's a cavity within the body, and that's what we call the sphenoid paranasal sinus. And probably we'll look at a lateral view, we can see it. But this depression is really important. It's called the hypophyseal fossa. What's the function of a fossa, once again? It's holding something. And in this depression right here, this is really important because it is holding the pituitary gland. Has anybody ever heard of pituitary gland in here? Anybody? Probably a couple people. Yeah, it's a really important endocrine gland in our body, and it sits right here, right at the base of the brain, right in this cella turcica. Okay, so that's a pretty important spot. You're aware of this. All right, so here I can see some nasal sinuses. And here is one in the frontal bone, just deep to the bump. Oh, anybody remember what this bump is called right here? That's the glabella. Yeah, just deep to the glabella is the frontal paranasal sinus. You don't have to say paranasal, but I have a tendency because usually it's on either side of your head. And it's in the frontal bone. Here is the cella turcica, right, which is in the body of the sphenoid, and right below that is the sphenoid sinus. I can see a couple pieces of it right here. And the other two that we can't see would be from the ethmoid bone and the maxilla, right, because they're going to be off midline. But the frontal and sphenoid are right smack in the center, so we can see these nasal sinuses really nice. All right, another thing that you'll probably run into again, there's a foramen right on the anterior edge of the mandible. And I don't see it on this slide, but it would be situated about where I have the cursor right here. Does anybody know the name of that foramen in this region of the mandible? Mental foramen. Yeah, because that's the mental region right there on the tip of your mandible. So that's the mental foramen, but there's another important foramen that is on the medial surface, the posterior medial surface of the mandible, and that is the mandibular foramen. Right, so I want you to know the difference between mental and mandibular. They're pretty important to know. This one is easy to find because there's a protuberance right here that you can palpate with your fingertip very nice, very easily, but you have to stick your finger in your mouth to do that. Right, but there's a nerve that goes in through the mandibular foramen, and that's a really nice nerve to anesthetize when you go to a dentist and they're going to be working on these teeth in the mandible, like drilling around or grinding them down. You don't want to feel that. So So this nerve is anesthetized, and that protuberance is a really nice handy landmark to where you can find that nerve very easily. Okay. All right, there's that nice ethmoid bone with nasal sinuses. Here's the perpendicular plate that helps make up the nasal septum, the superior part of the nasal septum. Okay, so that's pretty good for the skull. I think I'm done talking about the skull. Does anybody have any questions on skull or skull bones? Oh, guess what? I forgot these. All right, here are the four sinuses, right? The frontal sinus, ethmoid, which is anterior, then behind it, but still pretty much on midline, is the sphenoid, and down here is the maxillary sinus. So there are four sinuses, and you've got to be able to identify those for a practicum, for instance. Okay, and then here's this kind of mysterious bone, the hyoid bone, right, which is inserted within the mandible is a good way of talking about it. All right, that little hyoid bone. That might be a good one to know, too. Okay, so we're done with the skull. What other parts of the skeletal system belong to axial skeleton? So we're done with skull. What else do we have to look at in terms of axial skeleton? The vertebral column, which I see right here, including the sacrum, ribs, and then also anteriorly, we can't forget the sternum. Right? So those are some bones that we want to look at still. All right, so where are these located? Let's look at the vertebral column first off. All right, so here is the vertebral column, and you notice that I see a bunch of numbers. Right, and the lowest number is always going to be the most superior to a number which is a little bit larger, which is going to be inferior. Right, so the most superior vertebrae in the vertebral column is number 1. And we go down to number 7, and then we start counting over once again. Right, and then we get down to number 12, and then number 12 we start counting once again down to 5. So these different schemes represent different levels or different divisions of the vertebral column. So sometimes we talk about it as a level or a division, and they have some important differences. These, right, 1 through 7, these form the vertebrae in your neck. So that's why we call that the cervical region. You probably had to know that for labeling something on your test, the body region, cervical region is neck region. And we see that there's 7 of them. The next one below that is the thoracic region, and we have 12. Below that is the lumbar region, and we have 5. Sometimes there's a little anatomic variation. There might be somebody in here that has 11 vertebrae, okay, instead of 12. That's not a pathological condition. That's just a little bit of a difference. All right, but usually everybody has 12. And the sacrum down over here, usually everybody has 5, but notice these are all fused together that help make a nice bony plate. And then inferior to that, here's a little tailbone that we call the coccyx. These vertebrae are what we call coccygeal vertebrae, and there's usually 4, but there could be 3 or 5 in any person. And these are fused together as well. Right, so those are the different levels, and how are you going to remember how many vertebrae are in each level? There's a pretty easy way to remember that, and that is by the times that you might eat a particular meal. Like, when would you have breakfast? At 7 a.m. And when would you have lunch? At noon. And when would you have dinner? At 5. Right, so that might be a really easy way for you to remember the number of vertebrae in each one of these divisions. Okay, and notice that these vertebrae, as you go from superior to inferior, do they get bigger or smaller or stay the same? They get bigger, right? Because this vertebral column is not only armor plating for the spinal cord that goes through the vertebral column, but it also supports your weight when you're standing. So lumbar number 5 is holding up more weight than lumbar 4, and a lot more than any of these cervical vertebrae, so the lumbar vertebrae have to be a lot bigger and tougher. All right, so remember these different levels or divisions. let's take a look at just a typical kind of vertebrae. We'll pick one of these out. And this large bony mass right here that supports your body weight, we call this the body or centrum of a vertebrae. And this is going to be the anterior part. So this is facing a pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity or thoracic cavity. So this is anterior. On the opposite end of a vertebrae, we have a spine. And a function. What's the function of this spine right here? It's a process. And you're going to see that it's rough. Rough raised area is a process, but this is one that's sticking way out, so it's a spine. What's the function of a spine? Muscle attachment. Yeah, so muscles are going to attach right here. This is the part of a vertebrae that you can palpate very easily. On the back of your neck or on your back, you can feel all these spinous processes poking posteriorly. Okay, here is a bony plate that comes off the body of a vertebrae. This is what we call a pedicle. And then if we continue to move posteriorly, there's another bony plate that's attached to the pedicle, and that's what we call a lamina. And if we put both pedicles and lamina together, so here's a pedicle, here's a lamina, it forms an arch off of the vertebral body, and so we call that the vertebral arch that helps form the vertebral foramen. And y'all could tell me, what's moving through this vertebral foramen? The spinal cord, right? So the vertebral foramen is a passageway for the spinal cord. Right between the pedicle and lamina, I see another spine that's sticking off right and left. Right? It's really easy to see in a transverse plane. So these are what we call the transverse processes. And vertebrae have transverse processes as well. I see a smooth area on the body, and I see a smooth area on this transverse process. And this is a special smooth area. These are what we call facets. And since it's a smooth area, what could you tell me? What could you guess? What's the function of these depressions that are really nice and smooth? Okay, they're not rough for muscle attachment. They're smooth. So it's going to be for a joint of some kind. And on this particular vertebrae, what's going to attach at these two locations is a rib. Right? So a rib is going to attach right here. And here's a transverse facet. Here is one on the body. So that's pretty good for that vertebrae. Okay. There are some special vertebrae in our body. C1 and C2. And what does that C stand for once again? Cervical. So this is in your neck. C1 is the very first one. It's going to articulate with a bone of the skull. And use your imagination a little bit. Can anybody picture in their mind what bone of the skull C1 articulates with? Okay, so here is the vertebral foramen that the spinal cord goes through. That's a hint. What bone of the skull does the spinal cord go through? Occipital bone. That's right. So C1 articulates with the occipital bone. So here is a depression, superior articular facet, that's going to articulate with the occipital bone. And does anybody have a picture in their mind of what part of the occipital bone articulates right here? The condyle. That's right. The occipital condyle on either side of the foramen magnum. Okay. And this kind of looks like a little rocker right in through here. And so that joint between the occipital bone and C1 allows flexion and extension of the cervical spine. Do y'all know what flexion is? Oh, we haven't talked about that, have we? Have we talked about muscle movements? No, we haven't. Okay. So let's call that the yes motion. Can you give me a yes motion? Yes. That's flexion and extension. That's the motion that is allowed between the occipital bone and C1. But you know, you can look right and you can look left. That's called a rotation. And the joint between occipital bone and C1 cannot rotate. If it does, it's going to fracture C1. And that's never a good thing, because then part of that bone could move into the spinal cord and cause permanent paralysis and maybe even immediate death if that were to happen. All right, so between C1 and occipital bone is a yes motion, just because of the way these joints are formed. Okay, here is a transverse process. Here's a transverse process on C1. And here we have a special foramen. We call this a transverse foramen. And only cervical vertebrae have transverse foramina. So if you see a foramen in the transverse process, like right here, okay, or right here, you know it is a cervical vertebrae because there are important blood vessels that go through these cervical vertebrae that bring blood to your brain, and those are called the vertebral arteries. They're very, very important, bringing blood to your brain. Well, this C1, right, because it holds up the skull, has another name. There's only two vertebrae that have another name, and think of the mythological figure that's holding up the world. Right? There's a Greek mythological figure holding up the world, and does anybody know the name of that mythological figure? Atlas. That's Atlas, right? And so the name of C1 is also the Atlas because it's holding up your skull, which reminded somebody of a world because it's kind of spherical. All right, so C1 and Atlas. Atlas is a little strange because I don't see a vertebral body. Right? It's missing. This is where the vertebral body would be. Because here's the anterior part of it. Right? The body is anterior. But it's still in your body. It has moved somewhere else. It has attached itself to C2. How would you describe how to get from C1 to C2? Where is C2 with regard to C1? Where is it? Right next to it? On top of it? Inferior to it? I like that. It's below, right? It's right below C1. And if we have a nice... So here is that vertebral foramen. I see a pedicle and a lamina, the spinous process right over here. Here is the body of C1 sitting on top of the body of C2. The body of C1 is called a dens. It's kind of like your little fingertip poking straight up, and it would occupy the area where the body of C1 would be. Right? So this is a special joint. The joint between C1 and C2 allows for rotation. It allows you to look right and left because C1 will rotate right around the dens, right? And what vertebrae has a dens? What vertebrae has a dens? C2, right? It also has another name because of that special attribute, and it's called the axis. Because this dens acts like an axle that allows your cervical spine to rotate. But the joint between C1 and C2 will not allow for flexion and extension, which is the yes motion. If you're in a traumatic accident and this part of your neck is flexed or extended, it could break the dens off. Right? And if that dens goes into the spinal cord, that's immediately fatal when that happens. All right, so rotation between C1 and C2, flexion and extension between occipital and C1. But you should know the names of those two bones as well. Okay. Maybe another good picture of a dens right there. All right, so these are typical vertebrae. Oh, here's a really good nice picture. So here is C1 all the way around. Here's the dens sticking up from C2. And there's a nice transverse ligament right here that can hold these vertebrae together really nice. Right? So that allows for rotation. Look at that spinous process on C2 and the spinous process on C3. Right? Does this look different to you compared to that typical vertebrae that we were looking at? Yes. What's the difference on this cervical vertebrae? I see two points, right? Instead of one. This is what we call a bifid spinous process, right? Bifid meaning two, and that is also a distinguishing characteristic of a cervical vertebrae. Only cervical vertebrae have a bifid spinous process, and all of them have transverse foramina, which we can't see, but each one of these is going to have a transverse foramen going through them for that vertebral artery. If you stick your hand behind your head, up by your occipital bone, and then move down inferiorly, you're going to bump into a hump on the back of your neck. You feel that hump right there? Everybody's got a hump right there. We're not hunchbacks. It really belongs there. Right? And that's because C7 has an extremely long or elongated spinous process. And so sometimes we call C7 the vertebral prominens because the spinous process is sticking way out like that. And you can feel that really easily on your cervical region. All right, thoracic. Here are thoracic vertebrae. They don't have transverse foramina. They don't have a bifid spinous process, right? But they do have these depressions that are lined with hyaline cartilage. These depressions are for articulations with a rib, right? So thoracic vertebrae, by definition, have to have a rib attached to them. If there is a vertebrae that does not have a rib attached to it, it can't be a thoracic vertebrae. It has to be either cervical or lumbar. So if there are 12 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs does one have? They got to be exactly 12, right? If you have 12 pairs of ribs, you got to have exactly 12 vertebrae. If somebody has 11 pairs of ribs, how many thoracic vertebrae do they have? They have 11 thoracic vertebrae. Then we could probably find somebody like that. Okay, so here is the body. So only thoracic vertebrae have these facets for articulating with the rib. All vertebrae have these other processes, which I haven't described just yet. But here's a process that's sticking up superiorly, and there's a nice smooth articulating surface here. This is the superior articulating process with the facet. Here is the inferior articulating process of that same vertebrae. These are here because there's a joint between the superior and inferior vertebrae right at this location. Right, so the superior articulating process of one vertebrae articulates with the inferior articulating process, right, of the one above it, right here. And all vertebrae have these things. All right, so thoracic have these facets for articulating with ribs. So that's one really nice distinguishing feature. The lumbar vertebrae, big, massive vertebral bodies, right? No bifid spinous process, no foramen in the transverse process. They don't have any facets for articulating with the rib. All right, so if I had this vertebrae and it had facets for articulating with a rib and a rib attached right there, could this be a lumbar vertebrae? No. What would it have to be? It would have to be a thoracic vertebrae, right? Because that's how we define a thoracic vertebrae. So that's easy to see. All right, here's going to be a quiz for next time. All right, here's the body of a number of vertebrae that have all fused together. And this is a sacrum. And I can see some lines of fusion, right, where the bodies have fused together. So remember, the body of a vertebrae, is that anterior or posterior on a vertebrae? The body. Well, feel your back. What do you feel on your back? A bunch of spinous processes, right? So the spinous process is going to be pointed, sticking out, so the bodies are going to be anterior. And all these are fused together, and you'll notice that there's 5 of them. And the transverse processes have fused together as well to form something that looks like a wing, right? And a wing in anatomy is called an ala, right? So I see one on the left, I see one on the right, and it forms a depression. As a matter of fact, this whole sacrum forms a depression for, and that you could consider this a fossa for holding something like reproductive organs, for instance. All right, I see some holes. What do we call a hole? The general, most general name for a hole in anatomy? Foramen, right? So here I see a number of foramina, and these are facing anteriorly, so we're going to call these the anterior sacral foramina. If we look on the posterior side, I even see some foramina on the posterior side, the posterior sacral foramina. Well, these are there not because something goes from the anterior side of the sacrum to the posterior side, right? Something doesn't move through the sacrum completely, but there's something within the sacrum that exits anteriorly or exits posteriorly, and those are nerves. Those nerves are in a canal within the sacral bone that we call the sacral canal, and those nerves will exit posteriorly through the posterior sacral foramina to innervate things that are posterior to the sacrum. And there are nerves that exit the anterior sacral foramina to innervate organs and parts of your body that are anterior to the sacrum. So they're really two different sets of foramina, right? There's nothing that passes straight through, but there's something in the sacral canal that enters or exits through each of those sacral foramina. Here are the spinous processes, right, all lined up because they're all fused together. Here is a nice articular surface that we call an auricular surface. This is forms a joint with your hip bones to help make a nice strong pelvis. And then here is that superior articulating process and facet for articulating with the vertebrae right above it. Who can tell me the name of that vertebrae right above it? Lumbar. I like lumbar. But there are a lot of different lumbar vertebrae. Which one is it? That's one you have near supper time, right? Lumbar number 5 articulates right here. All right, so lumbar number 5 is going to have an inferior articulating process to articulate with the superior one of the sacrum. All right, coccygeal vertebrae. I see there's usually 4, but this can be another variable region. Oh, the sacrum can have a variable number of vertebrae in there as well. Usually it's 5, usually it's 4 for the coccyx. And the coccyx, all the vertebrae of the coccyx are fused together like the sacrum. So, the vertebrae in the neck, what do we call all these in the neck? Cervical, or C, like C1 through C7, right? And then we have thoracic, 1 through 12. And usually we don't take time to say thoracic, we're just going to call these like T1, T2, T3, all the way down to T12, right? And then here we have lumbar, including the most inferior one, which is L5. Yeah, go ahead and say the letter L5, because I want you to know how we talk about the sacral foramina. These are going to be S1, S2, S instead of C or T or L. Now, what about coccygeal? These usually aren't clinically important, but there's a distinction. Could we call these, this one here, C1? No, because C1 is really important, right? That's the atlas, and this is not the atlas. So we abbreviate coccygeal vertebrae with capital C, little o, right? So on a report, if you're going to read a radiology report or something, this would be capital C, little o, 1, 2, 3, or whatever, right? Standing for coccygeal. All right, so this is an important quiz for next time. This is probably the hardest bone in the axial skeleton besides the skull. And when you play around with this one in lab, get to know all of these different landmarks on it. And if you know the sacrum, that's the hardest bone, then you're really good with, you're probably really good with all the other bones that make up the axial skeleton. Okay. Let's look at some ribs, which was the very next slide. All right, so here I see a bunch of ribs, including this one right here. So tell me the name and kind of vertebrae this is, where I have the cursor right now. It's not labeled, but you should be able to tell me that is thoracic, or T12. Here's T11, right? Here's T10, here's T9, because you can count because it tells you this is lumbar, but you could also tell this is lumbar because it doesn't have a rib attached to it. Okay. Here, let's get the sternum out of the way. Here's the sternum, commonly called your breastbone, and the sternum has 3 important parts to it, and there are joints between these different parts, but in us, those joints have probably fused together to be just a single bone. The superior part is called the manubrium. The middle part is called the sternum, and the sternum is the longest part of the sternum, right? So here's the body. And then this little piece right here is called the xiphoid process. In a young person, that's cartilage, but in people our age, that has completely ossified and turned into bone. And that's an important landmark. Does anybody know why this is an important landmark? Ah, for CPR. I like that, but I forgot. Why is that important for CPR? Oh, when you're doing chest compressions. Yeah, if you're doing chest compressions, you would want to do chest compressions, for instance, on somebody whose heart has stopped beating. And if you compress their chest, that's going to help pump some blood out of their heart to various parts of their body, most importantly, their brain. And that little chest compression might get just enough blood to the brain to keep that brain from dying, and that would be great. Okay, so you need to push on the sternum, but the xiphoid process is such a little dinky bone, if you press on it, it's going to break off, right? And a broken bone is sharp, and then that broken off piece of the xiphoid process can wander around near your liver. It can actually wander around up to your heart and lacerate the heart. So if the xiphoid process is wandering around lacerating important visceral organs in your body, you're no longer helping that person, right? You're hurting them. So this is an important landmark. You can feel it on yourself very easily, right? And then you have to make sure that you move superiorly above the xiphoid process before you do chest compressions. And does anybody know what the rule of thumb is? How far above that xiphoid process you should go? Like probably 2 or 3 fingers. I like 3 fingers, okay, above the xiphoid process. And then you're going to be compressing the chest well above the process right here. All right, so that's the sternum, the most anterior bone. Notice the ribs articulate with the sternum, and some do and some don't. So 1 through 7 articulate directly to the sternum. So here's 1, 2, 3, let's stop, 3. Here's a piece of cartilage going from the end of a rib over to the sternum. It goes directly to the sternum. 4, 5, 6, 7. It seems like it's getting complicated, but follow this cartilage. Here it goes, curves around, and articulates directly with the sternum. So ribs that articulate directly with the sternum, or 1 through 7, are what we call true ribs. I see other ribs that have cartilage, right? So here is number 8, but where does the cartilage of number 8 go? Do you see a difference? Where does it go? To the cartilage of number 7, not all the way to the sternum. So that can't be a true rib. That's what we're going to call a false rib. The remaining inferior ribs are false ribs because they don't articulate with cartilage directly to the sternum. Right, so here is 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Oh, that's great. We didn't have too many or not enough ribs, right? So we got them all labeled. So here is a false rib. All these are false ribs, including these two down over here. Now, these two inferior ones, 11 and 12, they're kind of special as well. Can anybody see why these are different than all the ribs above them? No cartilage. No cartilage whatsoever. So these are floating ribs. So 11 and 12 are floating ribs, but because they don't articulate directly with the sternum, not only are they floating, they are also false ribs, right? Because they don't articulate with the sternum. Okay, so that's good for ribs. If we look at a rib, it's got some pieces as well. Okay, this enlarged area of a rib, this is what we call a head. If there is an epiphysis of a bone or a tip of a bone and it's enlarged, we call that the head. And if it's enlarged, that means that there's a narrow piece of that bone down below it, and that narrow piece we call a neck. Right, so here we have the head of a rib, here's the neck, and then we have a bump. Sometimes bumps are called tubercles, right? It's for articulations or muscle attachment. And then the rib bends around. We have a nice costal angle. Then here's the shaft of the rib. And then this is the junction where there might be some cartilage that attaches, for instance, to the sternum. So these are the parts of a rib. The inferior and medial surface of a rib contains a groove, a costal groove. And this is how arteries and nerves and veins get from the posterior part of your body to the anterior part, because these blood vessels and nerves can't go through your lungs. They have to take a pathway around it, and they are just situated in this little groove right here. Remember, a groove is a long, narrow depression. It's a fossa, and a groove has another name. Anybody remember what another name of a groove is? It's a sulcus, right? You could call this a costal sulcus, but most people call it a groove, but it really pretty much means the same thing. So this is how nerves and vessels get to the anterior part of the body. If you look at a head of a rib, you're going to find that there are some smooth surfaces right on the head. There's some smooth surfaces on the tubercle. And these are there because that's the part of a rib that's going to articulate with a vertebrae. And what kind of vertebrae does this rib attach to? Cervical? Thoracic? Only thoracic, right? Because that's the definition. All right, let me see if I can show you how these things articulate with each other just amazingly well. Right here. All right, let's take a look at the vertebrae first. We're familiar with the vertebral body, which is anterior. The transverse processes, right, which are midway through the vertebrae, and then here's that spinous process sticking out posteriorly. Here is the head of a rib, right, and it's going to articulate with the body of the vertebrae. Right, so here is that costal facet on the body of a vertebrae, and then here is the facet on the head of the rib. That helps make a nice joint. Here I can see it on the body of the rib, body of the vertebrae. And then the rib is going to course posteriorly. Here's a tubercle. That tubercle has a nice smooth surface on it that's going to articulate with the facet on that transverse process. So these things have really weird shapes, but when you get to lab, make sure you take a rib and take a thoracic vertebrae, put them together, and you're going to see how they just fit so perfectly and naturally together, right, just like a jigsaw puzzle. It's going to, by looking at the shapes of those two bones, it's really hard to imagine how they would fit together, but when you put them together, it will just fit perfectly. All right, and then you'll see these articulating surfaces as well. So that's pretty good. The vertebral column has some curvatures. Where's my cursor? Here it is. Has some curvatures. Let's look at some of the curvatures. I think go all, this is better. Better. Okay, so if we look straight anterior or posteriorly, it looks like the vertebral column goes straight up and down. And that's mostly true. You know what? But in this region, around T2, 3, and 4, the vertebral column is going to bend to the right a little bit. There's going to be a little bit of a bulge to the right. And that's normal. I don't see it on this illustration. Maybe I see it over here, but I really don't see any curvature. It just looks straight up and down. Why do you think the vertebral column bends to the right a little bit? It's making room for something. You got a really important organ that's mostly on the left side of your body in your thoracic region, which is your, it's in the pericardial cavity, which is your heart. Yeah, so sometimes the vertebral column makes room for the heart, which is situated right here. All right, and that's how we understand a lot of the other curvatures in the vertebral column. All right, so here we see, right, so here is posterior, right? All the spinous processes are posterior. Here are the vertebral bodies that are anterior. So where are you going to find organs? Are you going to find organs over here on the right or over here on the left? Right or left? Where are visceral organs going to be? They're going to be over here on the right side because here are the vertebral bodies. So these vertebral bodies in the thoracic region are curving posteriorly, and guess what it's making room for? Organs in the thorax, like lungs and the heart. So this posterior curvature, right, of the thoracic region is making room for important thoracic organs. Right, the curvature for the cervical region is anterior, right? So it's curving anteriorly, and that is to maintain balance. Your head is pretty heavy, and if your head would sit way back over here, right above all these spinous processes, when you're standing, you have a tendency to fall backwards, right? So this anterior curvature helps balance your body out, so it helps distribute some of the weight in front of the vertebral column. And the same thing for this lumbar curvature, right? It is anterior, just like the cervical, and that helps bring a lot of weight anterior on your body so that you don't tip backwards. And now let's look at this curvature of the sacrum. it curves posteriorly. Right? So this is making a depression to hold organs that are in the pelvic cavity, like, for instance, reproductive organs. So those are the four main curvatures. There are two that are anterior, the cervical and the lumbar, and there are two that are posterior, like the thoracic and sacral. So that makes room for organs in those body cavities. Right, I see something else that I haven't mentioned. Typical vertebrae. Here's typical. That's typical. All right, let's take a look at that. So here is a hole, right? And this is the vertebral foramen that the spinal cord goes through. Vertebral foramen. There is another hole that allows for nerves to exit laterally. If we look at a vertebrae, just a single vertebrae, we don't see that hole anywhere. So where's a nice picture of a... Okay, I don't see a picture... I don't see a nice lateral view. Okay, but if we put a number of vertebrae together, right, so here I see a number of vertebrae stacked on top of each other, do you see this hole right here? And right here? And right here? What's the name for a hole once again? A foramen. Okay, so this is not a vertebral foramen, because that's what allows the spinal cord to go through the vertebral column. This one right here disappears if you take these two vertebrae apart. I just see a notch on the one below and a notch on the one on the top. You take them apart, that foramen disappears. But if you put them together, right, I see this foramen. This is a foramen between two vertebrae. Right? And since it's a foramen between two vertebrae, we call that the intervertebral foramen. Right? So the intervertebral foramina we see laterally, and the vertebral foramen is right smack in the middle, right, of the vertebrae. All right, so there's a big difference between intervertebral and vertebral foramen. And in some vertebrae, there are transverse foramina. Does anybody remember what kind of vertebrae have transverse foramina? Only the cervical vertebrae have transverse foramina. So that is a really nice characteristic. You'll be able to tell cervical from any kind of other kind of vertebrae. Okay. Here are some abnormal curvatures of the back. All right, so if there's an exaggerated thoracic curvature right here, we call that a kyphosis. If there is an exaggerated curvature in the lumbar region, we call that lordosis. Right, and if there's an abnormal lateral curvature, we call that a scoliosis. Right, scoliosis, lateral curvature. So it all depends on how you look at the spine, and these kinds of pathological conditions can result from osteoporosis. Who knows something about osteoporosis? What is osteoporosis? When bones get really weak and demineralize. Remember, hydroxyapatite is the chemical that prevents a bone from collapsing, but when we lose calcium from our body, let's go back to this slide right here. Okay, if we lose calcium from our body, right, these vertebral vertebrae, or the body of a vertebrae, get very, very weak, and they can collapse like an accordion. And depending on how they collapse, it will produce these different kinds of pathological curvatures. All right, so I think it's probably pretty important to protect yourself from osteoporosis. Right, and so let's talk about how can somebody protect themselves from osteoporosis. And this is important for men and women. It's probably more important for women, but even men can get osteoporosis. How do you prevent yourself from getting osteoporosis? You need calcium in your diet. That's right. Calcium is an element. You can't make that in your body. You have to have that in your diet. But if you eat calcium, it doesn't get into your body. So how does calcium enter your body? Vitamin D. You also need vitamin T, and your body really doesn't make vitamin D. You need that in your diet as well. All right, so if you have calcium and vitamin D in your diet, that still doesn't protect your bones. Guess what else you have to do? You have to exercise your bones. Weight-bearing exercise will make a bone bigger and stronger. Remember, bone is a living tissue, and if you were to exercise a muscle, it would get bigger and stronger. If you exercise your bones, they get bigger and stronger, so that when you start to lose bone as we get older, the bone has more calcium in there to begin with, so it takes longer and longer and longer to feel the effects of osteoporosis. All right, so don't forget exercise. Diet and exercise, very important. The sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And I'll see the afternoon lab upstairs.